to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name is Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. This morning on Geek Speak, we're taking your calls with questions about your computer or technology in general. The numbers are 476-2800 or toll free at 1-800-655-5877. You can also email the geeks at geeks@geekspeak.org. Again, that's geeks@geekspeak.org, and we'll be glad to answer your questions or comments about technology or your computer. We'll be taking your calls right after the news. And speaking of the news, in the air room with me, Miles Elam. Miles, welcome to Geek Speak.
Good morning.
Good morning. What is out there today in the geek realm?
Okay, well, there's update information on SCO, was known as Santa Cruz Operation, or the SCO group, rather. We've talked about them in previous weeks, where they were suing IBM and about a dozen other companies, saying that Linux had copied code from the original AT&T Unix code base and used processes from that, and therefore were in violation. Well, it turns out they have cast a wider net now. They're actually taking aim at other Linux distributions. So,
and Miles, a Linux distribution, it's, what is it?
Red Hat, I'm sure, is a name that a lot of people have heard of at this point. You have Red Hat, Debian, SUSE.
And they're versions of Linux?
Linux is just the kernel, kernel being the basic layer that talks to network cards, to some extent to video cards, to your hard drive, to the motherboard chipset.
The core of the operating system.
Yeah.
And so
it doesn't include things like web servers or web browsers. And like, this is the very lowest level where the hardware meets the software.
So these distributions of Linux are basically companies that take this free software and kind of compile it together to make it work better in an install.
Right. It's taking it from the form of, we're not charging you per se for the software, we're charging you for the distribution of that software and the services that we provide with it.
And they do support and such of that nature.
Exactly.
Okay, so what SCO is doing, one of the founders of Unix, I mean,
well, they,
how does SCO
they have,
into this?
This is a long series of purchases. I believe the chain goes like this. You have AT&T made the original Unix code base, and then that code base was sold later to, sold to Novell. And so, in fact, Novell, everybody thinks of Novell as NetWare. They actually owned the Unix source code for a while.
Okay.
And then they were later sold the code to Santa Cruz Operation, and then Caldera, a Linux distribution, or what is primarily a Linux distribution in the past, had bought SCO.
Okay.
This is a really curious thing, is that you have a company who had run with Linux and is now suing, saying that Linux has gotten to the point that it has because it got help from IBM and others in populating with source code, even though IBM has a very...
Is this whole move from Caldera or from SCO kind of silly in your opinion, or do they have some merit to the case?
I mean, I haven't seen any evidence that they've put forward. In fact, they haven't distributed any evidence that we're talking about they're going to distribute it in the courtroom.
Mm-hmm.
Which I can understand. I mean,
but so the basic concept here is that Linux, an operating system, I mean, even has a name similar to Unix. It has a lot of similarities. But the idea was that Linux was rewritten from scratch and doesn't have any source code from the original Unix.
Right.
And so
that's the idea.
Caldera's basic argument in this situation is, well, sure, maybe it doesn't have direct copies, but it's based on Unix and therefore is in breach.
They're being very unclear on that.
Oh, okay.
Some people are saying it to mean that they do have some things that are exactly the same, except variable names have changed, for example. However, their premise saying that Linux could not have gotten where it is today without IBM making patches to the kernel and making changes is, frankly, a bit odd, in that Linux has been around for a lot longer than IBM has been putting effort into it. And the reason IBM put effort into it was because it was doing well.
Okay. Well, Miles, thank you for this interesting story. I'm sure we'll keep going on it as we hear more about the court case and as they release the information. Also in the air room is Dee Dee Hubbard. Dee Dee, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hey, how's it going?
What's your premier news item today?
I'm afraid that I don't have any news.
You have no news?
Except
no.
Except that I need to kill my alarm clock.
I guess so. Well, you came in time enough to at least be on the show, and I appreciate that. Miles, you did grab a few more news stories.
Yeah.
What else is interesting?
Let's see. Treasury Secretary and Commerce Secretary are urging Congress to extend the ban on internet-specific taxes that expires in November. Since the internet went commercial, there's been a ban on levying taxes on it. So any commerce that goes over, you can't say just because it's over the internet, there's a special tax on there. There's an internet tax. And this has actually fallen on the same rules that have governed telephones and the like, that states cannot put in a tax on using the telephone for long-distance calls.
Okay.
It's all federally regulated, and the federal government has said that there's not going to be any taxes. Probably in a move to keep the economy going is where this is coming from, saying that everyone should be able to freely communicate and purchase, and we don't need to put taxes on there to slow down any commerce that's going on the internet.
Interesting. What kind of effect do you think this will have?
If a tax goes into effect?
Yeah.
I'm honestly not sure. For the individual consumer, I wouldn't as long as the tax wasn't absolutely egregious, I wouldn't think it would have that much an effect. You would still have people buying things. Like, I can't imagine people stopping a purchase on a computer part. But I could see less purchases happening on the internet and more happening in local businesses because there isn't that huge price difference anymore.
Right.
I don't think it'll necessarily have an effect on what people buy. I think it'll have more effect on where they buy it.
Okay. In other news, Nokia has a new pen they're planning on releasing that you can take notes with a pen, like a normal pen, like on a piece of paper, and then you can beam the information to your laptop and get that translated into text. Now, this kind of thing has been tried before, and there's actually some technology. I've seen stuff like this before, but it looks like Nokia wants to wants to get this out to the open market, if you will. The digital pen SU-1B will let people write in digital ink and transfer the image to their mobile phones via Bluetooth, of course. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, very much so.
Another item, Miles?
According to Professor Lessig, the internet is dying. Those who don't know, Professor Lessig is the Stanford professor who argued against the Sonny Bono Copyright Extension Act and subsequently lost at the Supreme Court. But he's still a luminary trying to push for digital rights and for the commons. And his latest foray into this arena is going against the FCC's proposed relaxation of media controls. Basically, there are a whole bunch of media companies and people who have internet pipes, the broadband providers, are merging. And what you're ending up with is the people that can provide internet access, the cable companies, the phone companies, are ending up in the hands of fewer and fewer people. So what you're ending up with is, to quote Lawrence Lessig, the internet is dying. The idea being that robber barons from the turn of the century couldn't have hoped for a situation like this. Even they didn't have the type of control that's going on right now. The types of reasons why antitrust laws came into effect in the first place are basically being ignored at this point.
But I don't understand how that kills the internet.
Well, you can liken it to what's happening with radio, with Clear Channel. Clear Channel comes in and buys off local stations and then tries to pipe in somewhat fake local news. And most of the radio stations that you hear in Southern California are all owned by Clear Channel now. And so they kind of pipe out the same playlist all day, which is what radio stations used to do, but without the local flavor. And so there's one situation, I think it was in one of the square states, I forget, sorry. where an emergency was happening, and the police wanted to send out a message to people listening to the radio about like a freeway accident or something, and they tried to get in touch with the local, quote, radio stations for about 4 hours, and they couldn't get to anybody because it was all run by computers.
Yeah, right. Well, so that is like akin to what's happening on the internet now, because... Explain, Miles.
Well, to take another analogy, to damn another industry, Blockbuster has for a long time tried to get bigger and bigger, and they haven't held certain content. They're owned by a very religious family that doesn't believe that certain content should be available in their stores. However, one of their stated goals from years back was, we're trying to put every mom-and-pop business out of business. And what that means is, if Blockbuster takes over the video rental industry, say it were to take over for all intents and purposes, you know, 90% of the market, then what you have is movie studios that are making a movie, part of their revenue stream comes from the rentals after the fact. So if their rentals are going to be coming from a single source who doesn't want a certain content to come out, then a movie studio will be less inclined to make a movie that's going to anger Blockbuster, regardless of its merit.
And that's a great tie to like the radio Clear Channel issue. I totally get the issue. How does that happen on the internet where anybody can publish content? Why is it that some companies are consuming...
But can everyone publish content? If all of the providers, like say for example, you could only get DSL and cable through a single company.
Okay.
And they were both owned by the same company. Or more likely you had just two choices. All the DSL was controlled by by one DSL company. All the cable was controlled by one company. And it doesn't behoove them to allow criticism of themselves.
Okay.
So they could put that into their terms of contract. If they're not getting government funds, then it's not the government censoring you, which is where censorship laws come into play most of the time. They could say, you know, we don't allow people to do inflammatory content and have some vagaries in there, and then they can decide, oh, well, you're not complying with our terms of content, we're going to cut you off. It gives them enormous power as to who gets heard, who doesn't.
And that's the issue.
Besides, that's one of the issues.
Besides port blocking and countermeasures on the part of your ISP for you sharing information on the net from your own machine, because a lot of cable companies make it difficult for you to do anything with your line in terms of being a content provider if you wanted to do it from your local machine.
Okay. Like running some kind of server.
Right.
We're taking your calls today on GeekSpeak. This is GeekSpeak. I'm Lyle Troxel in the air room. Miles Elam, Dee Dee Hubbard. We're taking your calls with questions and comments about your computers. Please feel free to call in now, 476-2800. Or toll free at 1-800-655-5877. We'll even take your email this morning, geeks@geekspeak.org. Miles, more news, sir?
Yes, I just saw the new Matrix movie. I highly recommend it to everyone who liked the first one, which is, I think, a lot of people. But one thing in particular with that movie that I thought was interesting, and I'm not going to do any major spoilers here. No one needs to turn off their radio because of that. Was there's a scene where one of the members goes onto a computer to hack it, to make a change as one of the major plot points.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that if people familiar with The Matrix would know about. That's they hack into the computer system to try to free people or cause havoc in the system. And what is normal in computer movies, I guess the best way I can describe it, is the person who's supposed to be the great hacker sits down in front of the computer and this huge multimedia display comes up with a big banner flashing saying system compromised, enter password, you know, password accepted. And it was very refreshing to see a movie that actually tried to make it look close to authentic.
So it was boring.
When you had the character sit down... Well, yes. When you had the character sit down, you saw an SSH prompt, a secure shell prompt, prompting for a password. And when they typed in the password, nothing was echoed. Yeah, in other words, no one, if they were reading over their shoulder, they couldn't see the password, which is a common thing in the movies. And a nice little tidbit, in case anyone wants to really look for it, there was a password that she was going to be switching it to. I didn't see it in the movie, but I've been told that it's the case. the password was turned to Zion101. But you logged in through SSH, used a tool called Nmap.
All things that are used.
Yeah. Although she did use a fictional program called SSH Nuke. I guess I can forgive that because everyone makes their scripts and change it to whatever name they want.
And of course, it's the future, right?
Or is it it's supposed to be the present. It's supposed to be a representation of the present. But it was a refreshing change, I do have to say.
You brought up a really interesting point about passwords not showing back to the user what the password is. Mm-hmm. And that's not just about someone being over your shoulder, because, of course, if someone's over your shoulder, they could theoretically view your keystrokes, and they could just know that. It's about CRTs transmitting, and CRTs, of course, are standard televisions / monitors that have a big back, not flat screen. And CRTs actually... people know that they shoot out a lot of radiation. It's actually not very much radiation. But one thing you can do is it is broadcasting the information that's on screen, and even relatively close away, block up to a block away, you can pick up that information on that screen and view that image. So if you're viewing images on a CRT, theoretically, next-door neighbor could be viewing the same stuff you are.
Assuming they had very expensive equipment and a lot of time on their hands to set it up.
I wouldn't say very expensive equipment. Well, I'd say they had to be pretty tactical. But yeah.
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 Actually, technically, if you go into the Animatrix series, then the Matrix is in a somewhat not too far away but futuristic setting.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, good to know.
Well, they're still using SSH, so.
Well.
And it's unpatched.
it's because humans actually create the robots that eventually and artificial intelligence that brings them down in the future.
Okay.
Yeah. World War III and stuff.
Okay.
It's kind of cool.
We do have a call, thank
well,
God.
Well, it's actually not
from
college students, God.
John from Pulsar Robos, I believe. John, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, John in Kishawa. I've got a CGI error, and it's an error joke when I'm trying to upload my...
Okay. You're cutting out, unfortunately, John. I hope that you go ahead and switch back to the radio. I'm gonna take you out, but I think I understand your problem, and we'll address it right now. Basically, John is having what's known as a CGI error when he's uploading stuff to his bank's website. He is using the Opera browser.
Opera,
sorry. Or very musical.
Opera.
No. Opera. Sorry.
Yeah, the browser does not have its own talk show.
Good. So, Miles, what's the problem here? What is John running into?
Well, a CGI error is CGI Common Gateway Interface. It was the original way for content to be dynamic on the web. It's basically a program running on the web server, and the output of that program was the web page, as opposed to a static file, which is very common on the web today, where you just have a .html file, you upload it, and it just serves that flat file. This is very much like if you were to double-click on a program and the program spit out some certain content. It's that content which doesn't actually exist on the file system. It's generated by the program.
Okay. So there's a web server, and the web server has an application running on it. And when you access that page, the application does something and returns you information.
Right.
So this CGI error, is it because he's using this unusual browser? It's possible.
Oh, it's possible, assuming that the folks who wrote the program put in some type of specific hook to a particular type of browser, or put in a browser detection script where it ends up with...
Or something very strange could be happening where the post string's not the same. I would say that...
Now, those standards are pretty okay. What you'd be having from IE versus Opera would be the same. The transmission protocol is very well defined.
Now, Miles, when someone runs into a CGI problem, what have they done wrong?
Absolutely nothing. It's solely the responsibility of the person who's running the web server. There's a bug in the bank's code.
So in this case, okay, John's bank has a problem.
Right.
Now the possible problem that the reason why the bank hasn't fixed it is it might only happen on certain situations. Since he's uploading stuff to their website through his browser, it's very possible that the browser upload file is too large, or it's of a wrong file type that the browser is trying to do something with. But I mean, the server is trying to do something with. But in general, the bank has a problem, and the bank needs to fix it.
Yeah, in general, banks have reasonable QA. Something that serious, they probably would have seen something about it. I'm actually guessing that they're doing some type of browser detection script in there and they don't have a match for Opera, and you're ending up, you know, maybe like a null pointer being dereferenced or something, and the program's crashing.
Well, Opera is a great browser, right?
Oh, yeah, it is. Okay. Absolutely.
Well, we are taking your calls for questions and comments about your computers or technology problems you're having. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. You can also email the Geeks at geeks@geekspeak.org. We're taking a call from Tom from Santa Cruz. Tom, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
I'm a Mac user, and I'm out of range of DSL, and as I understand that, Mac is still not yet. They don't have software for satellite, and I use a 56K modem, and the best speed I can get out of it is about 26.4. And I just wondered, you know, do you have any idea of when the satellite might be available, or any advice I might?
Tom, I'm in the same situation you are. I'm not up on, Empire Grade, but I'm up in Lompico, and yeah, not having DSL or just digital subscriber link is really a pain because it's a nice, inexpensive, fast broadband access to the home. And if you live too far away from the colo location, of course, you can't get it. Satellite's a good choice. There's some issues with satellite. Satellites has a latency issue, so you make a request and it takes a little bit of time for it to get back to you. And that's mostly because the distance of the satellite into space and light has to travel at a certain speed and all that.
My provider is Earthlink,
mm-hmm.
and they say they only have it available for
PCs.
They don't have it available for Mac yet, for PCs.
Well, there are satellite solutions for broadband for the Mac, mostly because there are satellite boxes that you don't have to actually have any software at all or on the computer. You just get your network set up to be part of the internet or have access to the internet. So you'd have a kind of situation where people have in their home where they have a DSL modem, and then on the other side of that, a router. Sometimes it's the same thing. There's also satellite modem and router, but it's a hardware solution. And the reason why satellite's different than most technologies is that the way the satellite works is you receive your information from the satellite feed, but you don't send it to the satellite feed. Instead, you send it over your phone line. Now, that's not good for putting content out from your computer up onto the internet or to other people, but it's okay for downloading it. And that's normally what people are doing is finding files, but sharing just doesn't work through satellite.
Uh-huh.
So the issue is that, of course, if you're dealing with two different locations from your computer, that's kind of a problem. There has to be software on your computer that uses your modem to send bits out and receive bits in from this other system. There are hardware solutions to this, I'm almost 100% sure, but right now, I'm not surprised that Earthlink doesn't support Mac. Now, it's not that Mac is hard or difficult or anything like that, or that Apple's being hard. The issue is that Earthlink looks at their development time, looks at what they can support, and goes, well, we'll support 80% of the market because that's all we need to do to make our money on this product.
Sure.
And then later on, if it gets really good, maybe we'll supply it to Macs.
Yeah.
So be loud and complain.
Well, what would you recommend? You live
sure.
out of range, but you don't use the satellite.
I use dual ISDN channels. It's faster than a 56. It's expensive. I'm spending, I think, $35 for the phone line and then another $35 for the ISP. So, and no, maybe it comes up to like $80 a month or something like that for my internet access. And it's faster, and I like that aspect of it. But it's not the
faster
kind of
than a modem.
Faster than a modem, but it's not the kind of speed we see in DSL or even in satellite. Didi, you had a suggestion for Tom?
It doesn't look like there's a whole lot of satellite providers that are catering to the Mac at all, but I found an article at Mac Central at macworld.com. Hughes Network Systems is a provider of broadband satellite solutions. So I don't know if they're up in our area at all, but that's Hughes, like Howard Hughes Network Systems.
Yeah, I think I've checked that out, and that they have it mostly around Idaho, I think. Sounded like a really, really good deal, but
the thing is, their satellites, they might have a satellite that is in our area in geosynchronous orbit, and that's all you need to do. You could actually go through a company in possibly Idaho, though it sounds like there might only be a satellite. They don't have a satellite on the West Coast or near enough on the West Coast that we could use it. The other choice, of course, you can go ahead and try to get ISDN. The issue with that is that most carriers are trying to support DSL, and so ISDN is kind of like, you kind of got to get through the push for DSL by saying, no, I can't have DSL, I can't have DSL, I want ISDN, and you can get ISDN, and I'm sure you'll be happier with it than your 56K connection. The other thing to do for people that are on the fringe of the DSL is to say, order it and actually have it installed and try to get it anyway, and tell them you'll cover the cost and everything, and then risk the potential of actually getting it. You might be able to get it even though it's outside their technically accepted range. But that's not always going to work, of course.
Like making a bet.
Yeah, it's making a bet. And it really comes down to how close you are to the colo. If you're within a certain amount of time, you can, you know, can actually get access.
Okay.
Tom, thanks for the call.
Thanks for all the help.
Sure.
Enjoy your show.
All right.
Bye.
See, the internet can't be totally dying because Tom wants faster access to it.
I haven't kept up on it, but are there any cable providers in the area?
No. There's a lot of support. There's a lot of push for marketing for broadband cable. But what they're really saying is, we want you to have digital cable so we can charge you differently.
Might change with Comcast.
Comcast is coming into the area?
They bought out AT&T Broadband, which was serving the Monterey Bay area. So
we're always talking about media consolidation.
And there it is, yes.
Although I don't really like them as a company.
Okay. We're taking your calls and questions on GeekSpeak today. Phone number is 476-2800 or toll free at 1-800-655-5877. You're listening to GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air room, Dee Dee, Miles. We invite your calls and questions anytime. This program is supported by a grant from Cruise.io, providing internet services, including DSL and spam filters, for home and office throughout Santa Cruz County. Information about Cruise.io membership is available online at cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. My name is Lyle Troxell. You are listening to GeekSpeak.
This is Sean Cleveland, bringing you a Geek Bit. ATA and SCSI are two hard drive connection technologies that can be quite confusing and deserve some explanation. ATA, often referred to as IDE, dates back to the earliest days of the PC and is the most widespread interface used to connect hard drives, CD, and DVD drives. This is because almost all computers have at least one built-in ATA interface. The ATA standard supports two drives per connector, and, as a rule, a single drive is connected as the master, configured via small pins on the drive itself, while a second drive on the same cable is configured as the slave. ATA drives are mass-produced and are marketed for the more reasonably priced consumer market, and, as such, they are not designed to be as fast as their SCSI-based hard drive cousins. ATA connections are also relegated to shorter cable lengths of 18 inches. SCSI, pronounced SCSI, is an acronym for Small Computer System Interface, but it's anything but small. SCSI is a high-speed interface designed for workstation and server-class computers. Typically, a SCSI expansion board, called a host adapter, is required since not all computers come with SCSI ports. The SCSI interface has some very advanced features that allow for more intelligent data retrieval. And, unlike the ATA interface, SCSI can connect dozens of drives and have cable lengths of up to 3 meters. Since SCSI hard drives are designed for high-speed server environments, they are built to be more rugged and to last longer. And they have faster spindle speeds, the speed at which the hard drive platters are spun underneath the read head. Of course, these benefits come at a higher price. Speed is the main differentiating factor between these two hard drive standards. Consumer-based ATA drives are designed to spin their data platters at speeds of 5400 RPMs or 7200 RPMs. SCSI hard drives come in much faster speeds, ranging from 10,000 RPMs to 15,000 RPMs. This Geek Bit.
That was Sean Cleveland doing a Geek Bit for us. Sean's not here today. He actually has a job and won't be with us for a while. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. We are taking your calls about computer or internet technology, any technology in general. We have geeks Miles Elam and Dee Dee Hubbard. Join our discussion by calling 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877 or via the World Wide Web by emailing geeks@geekspeak.org. And from Santa Cruz, we have Robert. Robert, welcome to Geek Speak.
Yeah, hi. Hold on 1 second. I got to do something here.
Aha, we have a ghost of reflection, right?
Yeah, I just didn't want to have that echo.
That's great.
Okay, I'm trying to install a hard drive in my Mac laptop. It's a G3 400 megahertz model. And it seems like hard drives are really pretty easy to get and figure out, you know, for the regular tower computer. If you just kind of get one and you can plug it in, at least on the Windows ones, I think, you know. But on laptops, it's sort of hard to figure out, well, can I do that? Because I want a bigger hard drive. And where would I, you know, figure out what is the right drive to get and all that?
A larger storage capacity hard drive.
Yeah, because I only have 6 gigs and I put Jaguar on there. And so it seems kind of cramped because I'm doing photos and stuff now. And I've got about 2 gigs of free space. But I'd rather not go FireWire external if I can, you know, have most of my working stuff on an internal that's big enough.
Certainly. Dee Dee?
Well, I have good news. You bought a PowerBook, so they make it easier to do user upgrades with PowerBooks versus iBooks. With the PowerBook hard drives, you're going to be looking for a smaller form factor of hard drive that's 2.5 inches. And I believe they should be all IBM Travel Stars.
If they're not IBM Travel Stars, you might have problems if they don't match the actual one that you're in there. Is that right, Dee Dee?
Right. You can find the specs at Apple's site for what type of drive to look for. And I usually find really helpful tutorials online about complete with pictures and
on how to do it.
Yeah.
And it is kind of a complicated process, but the good news is you can do it.
I have a friend that might be able to help me, but I need to figure out which drive it is. So, you know, IBM Travistar, you said?
Yeah.
And it's a 2.5-inch hard drive is what I'm looking for. Is there more specs than that I need to be concerned about?
Let's see.
You know, you also see them referred to as laptop hard drives.
Right.
A lot of places will have them listed like that.
And there's a small form factor laptop.
Yeah.
But Dee Dee's trying to find something online right now for us, and I can add this to our site later today.
Yeah, that'd be great.
There's definitely going to be people that have already done it, succeeded, and put a write-up on it. So
Okay. We
can find that. It's again, you can do this kind of thing on a Google search, but of course, I'm glad you called the show. But Dee Dee will actually have this done in for us in just a second. But thank you very much for your call.
Yeah, I have one comment to make about
please.
The Jaguar system that I thought was kind of interesting.
Please do.
It's supposed to be like the modern operating system, and I personally love it. But I have a dial-up modem at home on my laptop, and I have a lot of line drops problems, which may not be, you know, the software's problem. But an interesting thing happens is that the connection software doesn't actually monitor the connection. It doesn't, like, my line will drop, and it'll say I'm connected, and the time will be clicking away. And then I have to disconnect and reconnect to get back up and running again, which I thought was kind of silly. You know, it's like, why doesn't the software monitor the connection?
That is a flaw.
Yeah,
I mean, it seemed like that would be a pretty big flaw on the system.
It seems like it. I'm wondering if the increase in high-speed access has led to a decline in quality assurance on the modem dial-up software. It's a shame. I haven't run into myself, but I don't use my modem on my computer, even though I've got one.
Well, you know, a laptop, you know, you would maybe be taking on the road and plugging into a dial-up situation.
You're going to need it all the time.
Fairly commonly.
Yeah,
know?
Definitely.
So why doesn't that monitor? I mean, it seemed like other software did. You know, I can't remember if, you know, the old Apple software would actually recognize, you know, if you were connected or not. But, you know.
Well, thank you for the call.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. We don't have John Tracy here today, but luckily he called in to help us with the opera question. John, welcome to Geek Speak.
Morning, geeks. I have to pardon my stuffed-up condition.
Well, at least we understand why you're not here.
I have had the same problem using Safari, which is Apple's browser, connecting to my bank site. It'll often give me a CGI error, and I'll switch over to Navigator, and it'll work fine. So a lot of times, I know Safari's a beta software, but still, sometimes the browsers don't quite interface with the CGI script that's running with the CGI.
Now, do you have the problem when you're uploading the file, uploading a file, or just in general?
It's just general, but I do get a lot of CGI errors with Safari. I don't use Opera, but I'm wondering if maybe it's the same kind of thing where the bank's website is really actually geared towards one of the major browsers.
Well, I'm sure they QA on the major browsers. And do you know, John, if there is on your bank website when you go up there, if there's recommended browsers?
Yeah.
And what do they list?
I know on mine, Explorer is what they recommend. And then they say also works with, and then they have Navigator.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is actually bringing to mind, I don't know if you can do anything for Safari, but Opera and to some extent I think Mozilla has plugins for it as well in Conquer. You can actually tell it to change the browser's identification string. So when it goes in, it makes it look like IE. It says drawbacks. I mean, it has the advantage of most of the time this solves all problems. Sad to say, but it's true. And Didi is pointing out to me that Safari does indeed allow you to do
that. You have to set the debug menu on first, though, which is a quick terminal hack.
So you have to do what, Didi?
There's a default file, or there's a default command that you can run in terminal to set certain properties for programs in Mac OS X. And I forget the exact command line, go figure, because it's defaults. Like
something cryptic.
Debug menu.
It's pretty complicated in general.
But it's just one command which you'd run at the terminal and then relaunch Safari, and then the debug menu shows up, which has some features such as shows you what all the keyboard and mouse shortcuts are, lets you change your user agent, and security level actually.
Okay. So what we're talking about, security, user agent, is the browser detection thing that earlier Miles was talking about. Every browser out there actually has a string that represents what it is, and whenever it makes a request to a web server, it sends that, quote, user agent. And the web server sometimes does different things in response to that user agent. But these errors of a bank's website giving CGI errors because of a certain browser, in my opinion, I'm assuming Miles shares this opinion, actually I'll let him finish the sentence, is what, Miles? Is that bad programming?
It's horrible programming.
Horrible.
I mean, the web should be made for, if you have a standards compliant browser, it works. The fact that it doesn't work for something like Opera or Safari, but it does work with IE, is 99 times out of 100. It's not because of anything technically superior about IE. It's because the people who were coding it for the bank, for example, decided it wasn't worth having the other. They actually disabled, for all intents and purposes, support for the other browser. They went, is this IE? Okay, get rid of it. I don't care if it would work or not.
Or there's some kind of odd bug in both Safari and in Opera.
Yeah, well, chances are if something's crashing like that, it's because of a browser detection string, or browser detection.
And they're doing special cases because of browser detection.
Yeah.
Safari, or it could be they're using ASP as a back end to the CGI script.
You know, even if you use... Well, if...
ASP and CGI are usually mutually exclusive.
Yeah, if you're using ASP, you're not going to see a CGI error. You'll see a really friendly Microsoft ASP error, which are common, of course, as well. But I think that a bank in general is not going to be using that. They're going to be using...
Something more secure.
An older technology, which is like CGI.
Yeah.
Not necessarily more secure, but banks move pretty slowly, as we found out last week with our ATM discussion on security. The financial industry moves real slow for technology, and that's probably a good thing because you don't want things on cutting edge where there's a lot of bugs. So they're using CGI, which is kind of, if I were to do a website now, I wouldn't be using CGI, the Common Gateway Interface. I'd be using newer technologies. But it's probably safer in a lot of ways.
And I have one more comment.
Please, John.
The person who is upgrading their PowerBook drive, you can no longer get the IBM Travel Stars. They're now Hitachi. So if you're looking around out there and you find a Hitachi Travel Star, that's what you want now. And right now they have a 40 gig and then a 80 gig.
Okay, and would an 80 gig work in a G433 PowerBook? Okay. So that's what you're looking for. Well, thank you, John. If you have time today while you're sick at home to write a little bit up about that and send that to me, I'll post that on the website, geekspeak.org.
Right.
John, thank you for your call.
Have fun.
All right. Get well.
I will.
We have another call from Francis in Carmel. Francis, welcome to Geekspeak.
How are you?
Quite well.
I have an IBM Aptiva, and I got a message that said I had a resident virus, memory resident virus. And so I ran... Micro Trend, and it told me that I had Delwin 1759-B asterisk virus in the memory, and it said simply delete it. But the window, which normally has a delete button there, the delete button wasn't lit up. And I can't find this particular thing. I don't know if it's not a file, I guess. And so how can I delete it?
Interesting question. You know, if you have a virus that's memory resident, it means if you shut your machine down and turn it back on, if it's only memory resident, it won't be there anymore. But
well, assuming that it's not launching from some program.
Well, then it's probably launching from some program, and the virus detection software didn't actually find that program is a problem. Do you subscribe to a service for your virus protection software? Or do you just have an installation?
I have it installed, yeah.
Okay. New viruses come out all the time, and you have to get virus detection libraries, which basically tell the software what to look for with regards to viruses. So it's very possible that you have a virus in your machine that is newer than the virus detection software supports. So you need to upgrade what is normally known as a virus detection library, and you can normally do that within your application, your virus detection application. The other potential, how do you first learn about that this virus existed?
The computer told me.
The antivirus software.
The antivirus software. And you're using what antivirus software again?
Well, the one that's in the machine that came with the machine is Norton.
Okay.
But I went to a website, MicroTrend.
Okay.
And ran there.
So Norton was the one that told you that it existed.
Right.
Now, see, Norton, you could go ahead and use Norton to delete it, too, if it found that it existed.
It happens every once in a while that you'll have the antivirus program will have a profile to detect the virus but won't have a way to delete it. It's unusual.
Right.
It's rare. You should definitely go and look for an update.
Yeah, if you open up your antivirus, yeah, you should be able to find a screen in there to update your antivirus library. And you need to do that. That's going to be crucial. When you run it again, does it find it again? Have you tried running that software again?
No.
Okay, try doing that, because it's possible it deleted it through the process of trying to delete it. It actually did delete it for you.
Hmm.
The other thing is, anytime you have a file I'm not sure what screen it was that the virus showed up that you didn't have a delete key. That concerns me a little bit. It could be that they just decided to delete, the software decided to delete it for you, and that's why it didn't offer you. I'm just letting you know. Which is disconcerning.
That'd be nice if it did.
It definitely would be.
Yeah. I had one earlier that the only way to get rid of it was the only way that I could manage was to take everything off the computer and run the recovery thing.
Yeah, that sometimes happens. Are you using Outlook for your email client?
Yes.
Didi, do you know how to turn off Outlook's automatic scripting?
Download the newest version.
Yeah. I would update your browser, your Outlook browser. Mostly because your Outlook email client. Because the reason why you're getting viruses, they're getting emailed to you, and you probably have an older Outlook which automatically runs them for you.
Uh-huh.
So if you ran Windows Update, you'd get the newest everything. And they've put in things into the newest Outlook so that it wouldn't automatically execute executables.
Which is kind of nice. So the way to run that is to go to open your favorite browser, open up Internet Explorer actually, and go to windows.microsoft.com,
mm-hmm.
and you'll be able to find the Windows update path, and it will pretty much do everything for you, but it will take a long time on a slow Internet connection.
Okay. Well, I'd be happy if it did that.
It should fix a lot of your problems.
Oh, great.
Thank you very much.
And will I still end up with Windows 98?
Yes.
Oh, it'll just be an updated version.
It'll be, yeah, they release patches all the time.
Oh.
And they should, and these are the kind of patches that they want to fix.
Okay.
Thank you, Francis, for the call.
Bye.
Francis called GeekSpeak to join us in our discussion, and you can too. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Another thing about viruses that is kind of disconcerting is lots of times people receive, and I always get reminded about this, people receive an email that will say you have a virus. If you receive an email that says you have a virus, even if it says it's from some virus protection company, don't believe it. Just throw it away, basically. Unless you've already subscribed to a service and you know that you get these kind of emails. But 100% of the time, almost, emails that tell you have a virus are some kind of hoax. So don't believe them. The thing about emails and viruses is that they're a good transmission device for viruses. But other than that, they're not useful in the virus realm. Would you agree with that, Miles?
Absolutely.
So what's going on with NVIDIA, Miles?
NVIDIA...
And who is NVIDIA?
Okay, NVIDIA is a video card manufacturer. They're currently vying with ATI for the top spot for the fastest video card, 3D video card, or at least consumer level. So when you're going out to play the best games, chances are you're going to be getting an ATI or an NVIDIA card, or at least one that's running with their processors on them. Well, recently, or up until recently, NVIDIA was the champ. And then several months back, ATI took the top spot. And NVIDIA's had a hard time leapfrogging and getting the top spot back. And their recent card, the 5800, I believe it is, they did benchmarks on it, and lo and behold, it beat the fastest ATI card that was recently announced. However, they found an anomaly, which was Didi.
Oh, sorry, it was a 5900. They found an anomaly when they tried running their own internal benchmarks and discovered that it wasn't performing quite as well as the previous benchmark. And so they did some investigation and found out that NVIDIA was skipping some of the things that contribute to your high score. The drivers were fudging the results a little bit.
This is bad news for NVIDIA.
Well, not quite so. The similar thing happened with ATI not too long ago with what people felt were rigged Quake 3 results.
Mm-hmm.
What's really bad for everybody is that these benchmarks are becoming... These benchmarks based on games like Doom 3 and Quake 3 are becoming such a crutch for the gaming review industry of the performance of these cards, because it seems as if NVIDIA and ATI are starting to cater towards these particular applications, that is like Quake 3 and Doom 3.
If we can get those two applications running really fast in our cards, and people believe our cards are fast, and therefore that's right. What we want to do. So what you're saying is that what would work in the situation of trying to test the performance of video cards?
I don't have an easy solution.
It's not an easy solution, I guess.
Yeah, reviewers need to play games. A wider variety of games, the games that they enjoy. I mean,
you're going to have
at least five different ones that you would...
So benchmarks are slowly becoming more and more difficult to use as a good, reliable resource. We got an email in from... I don't know who this is. We'll go with Cabin Trash as the from address. Is this a good time to buy a 17-inch PowerBook? Know of any hot feature rumors that means I should wait until July, Macworld? Didi? It's hard, of course, to have reliable rumors about Apple. They're very good about holding their cards close to their chest.
Oh, yes.
If you feel like you
secret.
Might be able to wait until July, there's no reason not to wait till July. Of course, in July, what might happen is they might announce the better, cooler computer that's not going to be really available for another 3 months. So what you're really waiting for in July, what you're really waiting for is like... later than that, you know, September time frame is when you're going to be able to get that stuff. Possibly, it could be, of course, that Apple releases it right away. So it really comes down to whether you want to wait.
Apple's actually also been avoiding announcing major things at Macworld conventions now. They've been secretly updating their entire line. The iBooks got speed bumped, the Emacs got upgraded, and there were no major press releases about it. It just kind of happened and appeared. So they might save, since this is Steve Jobs did declare this the year of the laptop, they might be saving up some big thing, but I wouldn't wait for Macworld for that. The one thing I could think of to avoid getting a 17-inch PowerBook, even as sweet as I think it is that I think I like 15 inches much better, and I know some people who don't want to be a guinea pig. Apple's first revision of anything, you know, they work out the bugs slowly, so... you might want to wait until the second round.
Yeah, if you want a true desktop replacement, the 17-inch might work well. If you're looking for a secondary computer, the 15 or even the 12.1-inch.
Cabin Trash also told us a good way to get a Mac to work on a satellite, and that is to buy a cheap PC, an older Windows machine and use that as the gateway. And you can do that by setting it up normally like the software company tells you to do or the satellite company tells you to do, and then just enable internet connection sharing. A little bit difficult, but you can always get a good someone to help you out with that in the arena. Our geek John Tracy does that kind of thing if you're interested in that. Let's see. We have from line one Bob from Santa Cruz. Bob, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hello, Bob.
And we've lost Bob, unfortunately. How about Veronica from Aptos? Veronica?
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question regarding Windows 98 second edition. When I'm loading, I had newer versions of a certain application, one called Dreamweaver and one called Fireworks. And it's like a studio, it's a combined kind of application. And it seemed to make my computer crash more frequently or having like illegal operations happening, you know, fatal exceptions and all that. And I was wondering if that's because the newer applications are made for later operating systems. You know what I'm saying?
Chances are they're just poorly written programs. Honestly, if you have a program that that crashes, that's just a problem with that program. The bug ends there.
Yeah, I think so. Of course, it's difficult.
Do you think, though, that there's a lot of times that they're making applications for newer versions of the operating system as opposed to...
I don't know how
they write.
I know what you're saying. It's very true that lots of times companies will come out with software for the newest stuff, and then they won't necessarily upgrade or bug fix software that works on the older stuff.
Okay,
but
okay.
In the situation of Windows 98 versus like Windows XP, you're not really going to find applications that work on Windows XP that don't work on Windows 98, except for in rare cases.
What's actually kind of sad is the crash protection that's in Windows 2000 and Windows XP may be contributing to laziness. Because if the program crashes in 2000 or XP, just the program crashes. You're not taking down the whole computer. Windows 98 is much more likely to go down with the ship.
Yeah, and that's, of course, the frustrating thing. Your whole machine crashes, right, Veronica?
Yeah, it locks up, basically.
And, you know, Dreamweaver and Fireworks, the great applications, web developers use them all the time. They're very common, and it's kind of frustrating not to have those. You alternatively could try HomeSite, another HTML editor, and it actually has a WYSIWYG. You could try that. They actually have a free...
I just reloaded the older versions back again, and there's no problem.
Okay. We also have a suggestion from a caller about this issue, so I'm going to say goodbye to you, Veronica, and say hello to someone that might be able to help us out.
Okay, thanks.
All right,
bye-bye.
Thanks. You have a solution to Veronica's problem?
Well, I just wanted to suggest, this is Stephen from Santa Cruz, a veteran of many different Windows platform programs. She really needs to check the requirements of her operating system for that particular software.
That's true.
Software can be written for 98, 98 second edition, Windows ME, NT4, NT5, the old Windows 3.1, and sometimes combinations of those because of varying differences in the underlying technology built into the operating system.
Totally true. Very good point. Thank you. What's your first name?
Stephen.
Stephen, thank you very much for calling GeekSpeak.
Sure.
And we're not going to be able to get to any more calls because we're out of time here on GeekSpeak today. The geeks in the house, Miles Elam, Dee Dee Hubbard, thank you very much for coming in and supporting GeekSpeak. This program is supported by a grant from Seagate Technology. Seagate is a worldwide supplier of disk drives for PCs and servers and innovations for products like the Microsoft Xbox, digital video recorders, and digital jukeboxes. Information can be found at Seagate.com. To those that called in, thank you very much for making GeekSpeak what it is. Without your input, it'd just be us yakking. Who wants to listen to that? You might want to listen, though, to Fine Print, which is coming up first. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP, Santa Cruz, KBDH, San Ardo. We're on the web at kosp.org. I'm Lyle Troxell. GeekSpeak is produced by Maggie Cleveland.